Welcome to STEM Spots, a weekly science review produced in cooperation with the Missouri State University Department of Physics, Astronomy, and Materials Science.
Hi, this is Dave Cornelison, and you are listening to the webcast version of STEM Spots. With me in the studio today is Dr. Anthony Clark, who is an assistant professor for the Department of Computer Science at Missouri State University. Thanks for stopping by, Tony.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tony, let's start off by talking about from where you came. So talk about, you just got to Missouri State a little while back. Talk about where you were before now.
Before I came to Missouri State, I was at Michigan State University. In particular, I was in the computer science department there. My favorite aspect of being at Michigan State University was this center there called the Beacon Center for the Study of Evolution in Action. It really heavily influenced my PhD research, and it gave me a lot of benefits that I wouldn't have been able to have at other places.
So that's an NSF-funded center, is that right?
Yeah, it's an NSF Science and Technology Center. And basically what that means is it's NSF-funded research. We can get little mini grants from the center, and that's supposed to seed larger grants from the NSF later on. What I liked most about it, though, is I got to work with computer scientists, mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, biologists, microbiologists, and so on. And everybody was really targeted at looking at, well, how does natural evolution have an impact on our field, or how can we use it to impact our own field?
So, for example, from a biologist's point of view, the stuff you're doing might help them understand better how evolution might proceed. And from your perspective, using evolution in your own simulations helps you. So talk about that. What did you actually work on while you were there?
Yeah, so I worked on robotic fish. That was what my research group worked on. And we used the principles of evolution to make our robotic fish better. So you can use evolutionary algorithms is what they're called. And they're essentially an optimization algorithm. You start with a population of robotic fish, simulated robotic fish, and you take the better ones and you recombine them sort of in a similar way to natural evolution. And that process leads to, after some time, better robotic fish designs in simulation. So that's how we used evolution to improve a computer science system. Biologists can then use the information that we got from that simulation to say, these were similar to the steps that natural evolution took. So maybe a living fish had this shape of fin at one point, and that led to this shape of fin when the evolutionary pressures changed from maybe needing more speed to needing more maneuverability. So maybe maneuverability is important for prey type living fish, and speed's more important for predator type fish.
So let's talk about that a little bit. Obviously, you couldn't do what a genetic system does in real life, which is take input from all the various systems. I mean, visual acuity, the ability to hear, the ability to sense, the ability to do motion. So you concentrated primarily on the movement of these fish. Is that right?
Yes. So for our robotic fish, when we're looking at making better robotic fish, we're primarily focused on how do we make them better at swimming. So how do we improve their maneuverability and their thrust? And to do that, you focus on, well, what determines most of their maneuverability and thrust, which happens to be the caudal fin or tail fin of our robotic fish. So you say, can evolution be applied to optimize the flexibility and dimensions of the robotic fish caudal fin to get better speed and better maneuverability?
And so when you tested for those things, so speed and maneuverability, speed, I understand, we basically straight line distance to distance or point to point propagation, but then how do you do the maneuverability? What did you test for?
It's a similar concept. It's just instead of straight line, you look at rotation. So maybe you look at turning radius or how quickly they can completely flip their heading. So you're heading in one direction. How quickly can you turn and head in the exact opposite direction? So you look at those kind of qualities.
So unlike the life cycle of a real fish, you can do this on a computer. So how many iterative steps might you go through your evolutionary process before you decide you're ready to build a fish?
Yeah, so you look at a lot smaller number of parameters in simulation, obviously. So you can use a lot smaller number of individuals in the population and a lot fewer iterations. So you're looking at maybe we have 100 or 1,000 simulated robotic fish, and they're evolving for 100 or 10,000 or 100,000 generations, as opposed to much, much greater numbers that you see in real systems.
So if you were to do a run like that, how long would that take on the computer?
So we used a supercomputer, a high-performance computing center, and So it's not completely comparable to using a laptop, for example, but it would run in over the course of around a day or two.
Okay. And then did you write the code for that primarily, or did you work with other people and write the code? How did that all work?
I worked with a group, and we split a lot of things up, but I did most of the code for simulating the robotic fish. So turning mathematical models into something you can run on a high-performance computer.
And that was written in what, C++, or what was it?
It's a mixture of Python, C++, MATLAB, Simulink, and a few other pieces of technology.
Okay. Okay. So then you also were involved in then hopefully getting to the point where you could make the fish. So did you make the fish, or who made the fish?
So I made some of the fish in our group. Some other of the fish were made by other people. I mostly focused on the smallest versions. So I did the micro robotic fish. So micro in this case, meaning on the order of centimeters. Not a great name. I usually call them compact robotic fish, but the technical term is micro robotic fish.
And so how long would it take you to make a fish?
It takes a lot of different pieces of technology again. So you have to model it in a program like SolidWorks, and then you turn that into something you can either 3D print into a mold or just 3D print into a product. So it would take several days, but you model it, and then you can 3D print some parts and then mold some other parts with liquid silicon.
And then inside this thing, there's some electronics. There's got to be, a servo or some sort of motors, power source. How do you get all that stuff jammed inside the fish?
So for the smallest version, waterproofing was hard to do a lot of the time. So the technique we ended up going with was you take your batteries, your PCBs, printed circuit boards, and all of your actuators and sensors, and you just stuff them inside the mold and then pour liquid rubber around them. So you end up with a very watertight body. And then you just have a few wires coming out of it for charging and reprogramming.
Now, was it important for the fish to remain oriented so that their tail is vertical or something like that? How did you make them do that?
So we worked on a variety of different robotic fish. Most of them, for practicality reasons, swam just at the surface, meaning they were always upright. They didn't dive into the water at all. They always stayed at the surface in sort of a 2D plane.
Okay. So you worked on that for a while, and you got your PhD, and now you come to Missouri State. So you want to expand that, move forward. What kinds of things are you thinking about working on here?
So here at Missouri State, I'm mostly focused, I'm shifting a little bit away from robotic fish towards a different type of small autonomous robot, and that's in ground vehicles and aerial vehicles. And how do you best combine those types of locomotion? So for example, my current project is working on a small wheeled vehicle that is able to change its traction on the fly.
Okay, and so by change its traction, from what different kinds of traction might it have?
The interesting part of this robot, so the research question this robot has is, how do we take a wheel and change its traction? So in this case, it has a series of little nubs, for lack of a better word, that can protrude out from the wheel.
Yeah, sure.
So they go in and out. So the idea is, well, if you're on carpet, you maybe want the smooth rubber surface of a wheel. But if you're in gravel, you can extend these little nubs and improve your traction. So the question we have is, how do you best determine how far out these little nubs should extend?
Okay. So then, and so you're trying to simulate the nubs too? You're actually doing this by simulation?
Yeah, so the first step is usually to prototype in simulation, because that gives us an idea of whether this concept would even be useful. So we can simulate a gravelly surface and say, well, does this simulated wheeled robot, does it even gain anything from having these little nubs?
It will in sand, but it's not clear that it will in gravel. Will it in gravel?
Well, so far, it appears to be the case. We still need to fabricate it and make sure what we see in simulation actually transfers to reality. But the principles we see in simulation seem like they will transfer.
Interesting. And so you've got this, and then you've got to decide, how do you get the nubs to come in and out? Do you inflate an inner bladder or something like that to push the nubs out, or how are you doing that?
So the current design actually control each wheel's nubs. And so each wheel has a DC motor that controls its spinning, so its rotation.
Right.
And it has a linear servo that pushes in and out and extends five little nubs for each wheel, yeah.
Very interesting. So talk a little bit about this whole interdisciplinary thing. Usually when you think about computer science students, you think, okay, you people are sitting in a room somewhere in their basement writing a lot of code, either to hack people or do something else. And so you've got a thing going on where there's people with mechanical design and there's also code. So do you have one person? Do you like people that can come into the group and do a little bit of everything? Or do you really try to break things down where each person does their own thing and then they just get together and talk about their things?
I like people to join my group that are interested in the topic, and I don't really have a desired skill set that they have to come in with. I'm willing to teach a lot of that. If they want to focus on just the simulation aspects or just the electronics aspects or just the mechanical engineering aspects, they can do that. I find that most students I work with like to get a little bit of each part of those components. So they like to work on the simulation a bit, but it's really satisfying to see, well, the simulation I wrote really applies to a real device, and now I can see this real device rolling around, so maybe I want to help build the testing apparatus for this real device. So I'm finding that I don't really require students to want to work on every aspect, but most students appear to want to work on all the different little things you can do with robotics.
And you're pulling students from where mostly?
All the students I work with so far are Missouri State University students, and they come from the physics department, computer science, and from the electrical engineering department.
And so where would they go with these kinds of skills? How's this going to help them when they get out of here? Just talk about that in a broad sense.
So broadly, the biggest gain I think you get from working with me is now you have me as a reference. It's always good to show that you've been working with a faculty advisor because now we can have really specific and good things to say about you.
Sure.
That's the pretty obvious useful aspect here. Other than that, though, if you want to focus on the software side, now you have a nice software application that you can discuss with potential employers. Or if you're really just interested in getting and moving on and working on robotics later, now you've got a full robotics application you can put on your resume when you're applying to go to a PhD program or master's program or to a research lab that focuses in robotics.
So when you talk to students before they come in to actually work in your lab, do they have a true sense of how this all goes? I find that many times students come into a research project, and once they get into it, they've always thought that research was one thing, and then they're kind of struck by how it's not what they think it's going to be. They think it's going to be all this amazing, everything works perfectly, and we all sit around and talk deep, deep thoughts. And in fact, most of the time, it's like your pants are on fire. So do they get a sense of that when they're working in your group?
We will. I'm still new, so most students are still new to the group. The software, the people working on software are finding that just like any other software, you spend most of your time debugging things. The people working on electronics are discovering most of the time you're spending your time figuring out why something broke or doesn't work. But what most of them will discover soon, actually, is that most of research is actually writing. So they'll have to help me put this together and put it and package it in a way that the research community will be interested in what we've actually done.
So your goal is to actually make one of these. How big would this thing be? This is sort of a micro robotish thing too or not?
Yeah, so it's roughly the size of your fist. That's about the size of the device, and it's about 20% fabricated at the moment with a combination of 3D printed parts, a Raspberry Pi for the control, a bunch of motors and things like that.
And then you actually test it out on a test bed that you've created, or?
Yep. So the test bed's in design. That's not completed yet. But yep, it'll be tested in the lab, and then eventually it'll be tested in outdoor environments as well.
Very nice. Well, Tony, I really appreciate you coming by and talking about all the things you're doing. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this is Dave Cornelison for the webcast version of STEM Spots. And if you have more interest, you should go to Computer Science website and look up some of the things that Tony and some of the other people there are doing. And I hope you'll listen in again next week. This is Dave Cornelison signing off.
STEM Spots is available online at ksmu.org.